we're just going to show a video as we start, but we want to have
just gonna set the mood.
An interactive conversation, which is hard to have when people are far flung. So if you don't, if you can just not be shy and come up to the front, that would be great.
Okay, this, for those people who are not yet familiar with it, there was an uprising in Madison, Wisconsin last year. This is just some footage from that that's going to set the stage for our conversation today. So if people have questions about it or what actually is happening in here, we can talk about that during the conversation as well.
Fellow supporters of Wisconsin labor, are you as mad as I am?
Yeah.
So for those that came in after we started that, that was from the uprising in Madison, Wisconsin last... This is from February, when something like 100,000 people in the snow and the cold started something that is continuing the last year and a half. So we'll start from there, just to set the stage.
Do you want to introduce us?
Yeah, let's say who we are. I'm Tristan. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I am a volunteer labor organizer at a workers' center in Tennessee, and a student. And I went to BYU, which is what pulls me back around these parts.
I'm Ash Sanders, and I am a community organizer here in Salt Lake. And I work with a lot of different groups, including I've been down at the ALEC Welcoming Committee all week, or part of the week, protesting ALEC. And I work with Peaceful Uprising, which is a climate justice group here. And I also work with Move to Amend, which is a group trying to get corporate personhood abolished and money out of elections. I work for that group on the local level and on the national level. So those are, and I do political street theater, which is my favorite thing. So that's me.
And then I'm Joshua Madison, and I'm like Tristan Nash. I'm not quite the activist they are. I am a writer, editor for the Mormon Worker paper, which has been on a bit of a hiatus with blogs still there. Also, been at Claremont this year on Occupy Zarahemla, discussing Occupy movements and Mormon thought earlier this week as well. And I've been mainly writing and have things coming out just on issues of war and arguing for a pacifist approach to our Mormon heritage.
So I'm going to start out with a little bit of an opening that may seem familiar to y'all, but just to get everybody on the same page. There's been increasing talk about Romney's Mormonism and his membership in the 1% this electoral season. So here's a nice example for people that might not yet be familiar with the conversation. This is from Troy Williams' article from a few months back, when Mormons were socialists. Mitt Romney and City Creek represent the culmination of a great transformation within Mormonism. As an outcast faith, early Mormons experimented with communal living and alternative marriages. In 1848, Brigham Young famously declared, "There shall be no private ownership of the streams that come out of the canyons, nor the timber that grows on the hills. These belong to the people, all the people." Young's egalitarian separatism has long been superseded. The living embodiment of the 21st century saint is now the slick, painfully monogamous, politically malleable, super-capitalist Romney, who shares humorous tales of layoffs and factory closures. Romney perfected the art of creative destruction through leveraged buyouts and junk bond financing that enriched his investors at Bain Capital, while at times devastating common workers. His critics from the 99%, he argues, are driven by envy. That may seem familiar with a lot of discussions going on, or a combination of discussions. So to explain with this panel what we're sort of trying to do here, it'll be a little bit of an experiment. The panel is, we're going to try to assess some resources, so we're going to ask for some participation in assessing the resources that we have here in the room, see where we are, where we want to go. We're not going to necessarily assume that people are coming with all the same ideas in the room, but we want to see what those are. And we could leave this room with some really concrete plans as a group and a game plan. We could leave with just the beginning of a conversation and a few people identified that want to work together in the future. So we'll see where that goes. We have three clarifications before we begin our presentations. I'm going to give the first, Ash will do the second, and I'll come back with the third one. The first is that we've had a lot of panels about Romney, a lot of discussion about Romney in both of these electoral seasons that he's been a candidate, and specifically, usually, about what his candidacy means for Mormonism. At base, though, for us, we're trying to question, what does his candidacy mean for the rest of the world? We want a class analysis, we want a structural analysis of Romney's presidency, a potential presidency, and of the political and economic strategies that Romney and his allies are trying to implement, what the consequences of those strategies will be on the people targeted. By those strategies, we mean some things that are well exemplified this week by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which today is concluding a week-long conference at the Grand America Hotel downtown. Some of those objectives being dismantling environmental protection laws, the Stand Your Ground laws that came to public attention after Trayvon Martin's killing, legislation seeking the deportation of migrants, union busting, expansion of private prisons, and many, many more. We see the implications of the Romney campaign on Mormonism as intriguing, but we see the implications of his campaign on the oppressed of the world as a life and death moral catastrophe.
And so, clarification two for everybody keeping track at home. We also are here because we want a different response to the question of Mitt Romney's potential presidency than has been normally discussed in Mormon circles. And Tristan and I both noted that we were community organizers, and we just can't help ourselves. That's how we think. And so I think that the work so far, Mormonism and at Sunstone, Sunstone people are very good at writing excellent treatises and exploring ideas, and that's very important, and that definitely has a place in movement building. But we want to challenge ourselves as a group to actually organize and do something about the problem and do something to combat the problem. And so we're kind of operating, if you want to use a faith adage, on the idea that faith without works is dead. And we are, and works in this instance would be actually organizing against power. And to talk about this, I just want to bring up a brief analogy that people often use to talk about power and whether you have a liberal notion of how power works and therefore a liberal response, or a radical notion of how power works and a radical response. And I think it's probably not surprising if you've read our abstract that we on this panel want a radical approach to change, but we need a lot of different kinds of approach. But one example that one analogy that's often used to talk about power is the analogy of a bird in a cage. And the bird, obviously, is sitting on a little perch, and it's surrounded by bars that keep it inside. And the question is, how do you see that bird? If that bird is a metaphor for oppression in the world, how do you see that bird? Do you believe that the bird is still capable of doing most of what it wants to do as long as it changes its attitude about being in the cage and therefore can use the space in the cage for its own exploration and self-actualization? Or do you believe that the bird is fundamentally different because it exists in that cage and in that space and in those structures? And do you believe that the correct or the best way to approach this bird in the cage is to talk to it about the fact that it is in a cage and lead it through, you know, meditations or whatever. I'm not trying to like mock one approach or the other. I'm just trying to clarify some different approaches. Do you talk to the bird in the cage and think about what it means to be in a cage, etc., or do you dismantle the cage bars? So those are two questions too, right? And so we are going to need all kinds if we're going to resist the 1% of the world and do what Mormonism is historically uniquely capable of doing, which is creating societies of justice and collectivism. But we also need to figure out what that means for us. And so we're here to push it in a more radical direction and talk about how we address the roots of the problem and how we also organize to change material reality. And I've been in a lot of panels today. We've talked about racism or women in the priesthood and other things, and they were really good panels for the most part, but there was a conspicuous absence of talking about organizing. So I want to challenge you as Mormons to think about the fact that we could actually get what we want. Sometimes we talk about injustice and we analyze it, but then we think because we live in a hierarchical structure, we actually can't get what we want, whether that applies to the nation or our religion. And I'm here to say that if you organize, you can do a lot of things you didn't think you could do. So we want to organize. So we're coming at this from an organizer's perspective, and we hope that you'll join us in that perspective and that quest, if only for an hour.
Sure. And so then the third clarification, which is pretty important, we realize, and I think Josh is going to talk a little bit more about this, so I'll be pretty brief on it, is that we should be very clear that we're not, by implication, supporting Barack Obama, whose foreign policy is nearly indistinguishable from Bush or Romney's, and whose domestic policy is quite a bit less different than is commonly supposed. Pretty much all of the world's movements against capitalism oppose both Romney and Obama's political projects, and most of those movements see them as, in fact, the same political project: neoliberalism economically and military expansion globally. Just for clarification of where we're coming from on that. So now we're going to do some brief presentations, starting with Josh, and then I will, and then Ashley, to explain a few of the things that are bringing us to this resistance party.
Oh, and I, that reminds me too is that this is also going to be an interactive panel, because you can't organize if you just present at people. So we're going to be collecting your thoughts on how you see an effective resistance to economic inequality, Romney, et cetera, whatever Romney stands for to you, what you see as effective ways of pushing back against that and struggling against that. So keep that in your ticker, and we will come back to it later.
Well, I'm going to be very brief, mainly because we want to hear your ideas and thoughts. And most of what I have to say about a lot of these issues I said Thursday. So I'm just going to talk briefly. Since we're at Sunstone, I assume most people have a certain persuasion. Nevertheless, when Tristan asked me to be on this panel, I was thinking, well, why would Mormons be against Romney? Well, given the current state of Mormonism, I don't think they should be, you'd think. Mormonism has become more militaristic. Mormons have helped create torture through and then if you look at the church itself, you know, it's fully embraced capitalism, shopping malls, and Tiffany's, and these things. So from a certain perspective, you can see why many Mormons would look at Mitt Romney and go, he's a perfect candidate. Or as I put it, he represents the worst of Mormonism, but the current mask of Mormonism. And so part of what I think is important for Mormons and why we might find a reason to be against Romney is it's part of reclaiming Mormonism's utopian and radical roots, you know, that we've sort of left aside instead because we wanted religion. And so in that vein, let me approach it this way. Matt Taibbi, last January, he made a comment, and this goes to what Tristan was saying about Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and partisan politics, that in the world, like the video, or the other Occupy movements we've seen, and all throughout the world, we see the influence of money that it has on politics and the state patronage of big business going on everywhere. And people have been reacting against this. They've done it in the streets. They've done it in the courthouses. They've done it in their homes when they've refused to move out of foreclosed homes. They've done it in gardens even now, in all sorts of different ways. But the one place we don't see that battle taking place is in the national presidential race between Romney and Obama. As Matt Taibbi put it, the campaign is a gigantic ritual. It will be attended by all the usual pomp and spectacle, but it's an empty ritual because it's a contest between 1% approved candidates. The campaign arguably should be the hated symbol of the 1%. It's a campaign to choose the next imperial administrator, or we could call it the 1% off. And so why should Mormons speak out against Romney? Partially, we own him. I guess he's one of our own. And so I guess that duty falls on us to speak against him. Also because of his policies and his beliefs and the effect they'll have. So from a Mormon perspective, one of the things that stands out to me about Romney is this idea, which is at the heart of all the Occupy movements, that money, corporations have ingratiated themselves in the political sphere, where they could collude with government in order to get even more rich and more power. In other words, as Mahan principle would say, that they might murder and get gain. And this, is what the heart of what Romney's about and what his ideas are about. So Romney represents a system where all the resources of the world aren't used to sustain life, but instead, life itself is converted to property. It's a counterfeit economy where one has to sell themselves in order to obtain what God has given. In Romney's world, you can have anything, but you have to have money for it. And that will require a conversion of life, either yours or someone else. So for example, in a recent statement that I found very telling, Romney said that we must have private health care so that everyone can get the care they deserve. Right? So what does this mean, the care you can deserve? In other words, what you deserve is what you can buy. That's how we determine merit, how much money you have. And this ties intimately into what I believe the Book of Mormon argues, that groups will obtain, quote, the sole management of the government, they'll destroy, quote, the regulations of the government, and thereby, quote, trample the poor and meek under their feet, while the, quote, guilty and the wicked go unpunished because of their money, so they, quote, might get gain and glory of the world. Just recently, we could see Romney where he appeared before the NAACP. And of course, after he appeared there, what he told everyone is, I tried to reason with those black folks. I really did, but it turns out all they want is free lunch. Now, this is really offensive when you think about it. We just saw the biggest free lunch handout in history to Romney's Wall Street pals who destroyed the economy, right? And so here he is mocking these individuals. And so what we have in our nation is a mockery of the biblical concept of Jubilee, where instead of debtors being bailed out, we actually bail out the creditors. we look at militaristically, Romney speaks of Iran, about his desire to attack Iran, bomb Iran, and that he can do this without any approval. This is, of course, the military angle. It's just another way that the business is tied into the military. Smedley Butler wrote about this ages ago, calling war a racket. It's a muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, for the bankers, a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. It's interesting to me as well when you look at the way that most people don't realize that the modern banking system was actually created to fund European wars. The British pound, for example, is largely circulating war debt. In 1694, King William received 1.2 million pounds to fight a war in France from London merchants, who in exchange got the right to call themselves the Bank of England. And what did they loan out? The king's debt. These were the pounds. And so the economic aspects of war are very tied in together. The anthropologist David Graeber laid out these facts about the U.S. that I think are very important to keep in mind. The U.S. spends more on its military than all other countries on Earth combined. It maintains at least 2.5 million troops in 737 overseas bases from Paraguay to Tajikistan. And unlike any other military power in history, it retains the power to strike with deadly force anywhere. Just look at the examples of the drones that Obama uses so effectively in killing little children. They can hit anywhere, right? So the U.S. dollar is also the currency of global trade. And since the 70s, it's replaced gold as the reserve currency of the global banking system. So what does this mean? Well, if we look, since the 1970s, the U.S. has come to run an ever-increasing trade deficit, whereby the value of products flowing into America outweigh the value of those American products that we send out. Now, if you look at these facts, as Graeber points out, it's hard to imagine they could be entirely unrelated, particularly when one considers that for centuries, the world trade currency has always been that of the dominant military power, and that such military powers always seem to have more wealth flowing into them than they send out. Still, the moment one begins to speculate on this, you know, you're called crazy or paranoid lunatic. So let me just, in closing about Romney, I think one thing important about him is during the debates, and I think this reveals for me where he really stands in contrast with some of what I consider the best of Mormonism. He was in one of the debates at his holy lectern, you can imagine, like much like the Zoramites up there, and he says, "I didn't inherit my money from my parents. What I have, I earned. I worked hard the American way." In other words, what he was saying, I deserve the wealth I have because I alone earned it. Those who are poor deserve their poverty because they have failed to earn wealth. You see, if the American way means anything, it means never acknowledging the hand of another in your success. You can acknowledge invisible hands, but never anyone else. And I think Hugh Nibley pointed out clearly that we should always be wary of people that talk like this, because no one is more completely of the world than one who lives by the world's economy, no matter what kind of piety they have, their open displays, their family life, all these things. This is at the heart of the Book of Mormon, that Samuel talks about, when you set your heart upon riches and you don't remember God, this is what happens. So in closing, as I was thinking about Romney and why we should really stand up to him, if you look at Mormon scripture, Romney really does represent the worst of what I would call the Nephites, right? These are individuals who, at different points in their history, begin to despise and grind the face of the poor, rob and oppress them by withholding food, clothing from the naked. It's a culture that becomes obsessed with vanities, costly apparel, obsessed with mammon, leading to class distinctions, great inequality. Not only does inequality reign in the land, but even it says in the Holy Church, they love money and substance and fine apparel. And we only need to walk, you know, a few blocks down the street to see this new mall that sort of epitomizes this. This is, of course, vastly different than what the First Presidency said in 1875, that one of the great evils our nation is menaced with is the growth of wealth in the hands of a few. So when I look at Romney, I say he does represent the worst of Mormonism. By that, if the Book of Mormon is a text that's laying out all these sort of societal ills, Romney is essentially saying, I'm going to do exactly what they did. And we know how it ended for them. They ended up destroying themselves. If, on the other hand, it's a text that says, learn from their mistakes, don't do what they do, and much in the vein of Latin American liberation theology, except with a twist, written to the mighty imperial powers, written to those in charge, says, yeah, you can do those things, but there's another way. Give up your power, give up your money, give up your control, military and otherwise, and you can be saved. And if you don't, if you don't do that, you'll be condemned. So for me, I think that's why Romney matters. He's one of our own, and I think it's important to stand up against him with our own doctrine, our own thoughts, and say, yeah, he represents maybe the current face of Mormonism, this mask we have, but that's not the best of Mormonism. And the best of Mormonism tells us that what he's doing is the worst of Mormonism.
Do anarchists clap? Or do we clap?
Do you like this?
So, I'm going to talk a little bit about repentance. Ultimately, as everyone knows, this isn't actually about Mitt Romney. A lot of Mormons are sensitive to the targeting of individuals, when the real problem is a structural problem, the entire system, and we want more subtlety. Why focus on Mitt? He's just one guy. He doesn't represent all Mormons. This is, of course, true. But Mitt is not, in fact, just one dude. He's a brand. He's one of an entire class of elite reactionaries that are trying to reestablish class power in a time of rising protest. He's a fabulously wealthy manipulator of others' lives. And he does, whether we like it or not, represent Mormons. We lend him our infrastructure, our listservs, our college graduates, our campuses. Harder to see, but more importantly, he represents our own complicity in allowing war and capitalism to take root, not just in Utah, but imposed on resistant populations all over the world. I'm going to follow just one example. In 2007, Romney said to the Miami Herald, "The investments for the company that I started, Bain Capital, came largely from Latin America. My largest single investors came from El Salvador, Ecuador, Colombia, and Guatemala. And so I feel a deep kinship to the people in Latin America." Right. The biggest investors seem to have been from El Salvador, from the infamous 14 families that constitute the national oligarchy, own most of the land, most of the industry, and were largely responsible for using U.S. military funds and equipment to massacre tens of thousands of their own citizens during the Salvadoran Revolution of the 1980s. Bain recruited their capital beginning in 1984. Stories from Colombia and Guatemala are, if anything, more damning. But while Mitt's own finances are a great and vast example of this kind of imperialism, our response to it has to be structural. This is not just about Mitt. This is about resistance to an unjust and enormously destructive political economy that today is called capitalism. Mitt is its ambassador, but he is not it. He's just a vehicle for the class power of owners and bosses that we've been learning to call the 1%. But similarly, he's a vehicle for us, for channeling resistance to that 1%, a movement of resistance that predates Romney and hopefully will outlast him. So if this goes far beyond the particularities of Mitt and Mormonism, then why are we presenting this here, at Sunstone, with Mormons? I believe in the doctrine of repentance and of atonement. We as a people have allowed this to happen. We have some guilt to bear for the suffering caused by war, and I suggest that if you ever let your guilt run wild, let it be now. Our peculiar people created this man who would be king, who says, "I'm not concerned about the very poor," on cable news. Our repentance can't be personal, like Pontius Pilate saying he doesn't represent all Mormons and turning our eyes from the damage that he will do in our names. Our repentance has to be real. It has to be material. It has to be trying to undo a great wrong. This is our chance for redemption as a society. Mitt Romney's book is titled No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. Again, it's titled No Apology. This is the firmest rejection I can imagine of the doctrine of repentance and the possibility of atonement. Mitt channels equally from the LDS refusal to deal with structural or historical critique and the United States' same proclivities to erase and deny history. Mitt Romney's No Apology is the imposition of the principle of the Mountain Meadows Massacre to the world stage. So along with these short expositions, we're also going to share a couple of ideas that we have of ways that we might move forward. There's one that I've been working on that I'm going to share briefly, which is the replication of visit of Zion's Camp. For those that are familiar with Zion's Camp, remember it. For those that aren't, we can talk afterwards. But the recreation in this case would be channeling the memory of the original reasons for Zion's Camp, right? This was a march from Ohio to Missouri because our Mormon brothers and sisters were being expelled from their homes at gunpoint, right? A march of hundreds of armed men to go in solidarity with those people who were losing their homes. It's a complicated story, and there wasn't one easy side. I'm using it as a vehicle, right? So what this would look like in replication terms would be, we're very good at pageantry as a society. We've got hand carts on hand. We've got bonnets. We've got robes.
Not like right
and,
here.
Yeah, no, under the table right here. We've got white robes and golden trumpets. And we can walk the same way that the Zion's camp did, in their case, from Ohio to Missouri, from here to Ogden, along I-15, where after our undocumented neighbors' doors are kicked in and they're put into detention, that's where they're taken before being expelled from their homes at gunpoint by some of the same methods that were used to expel our brothers and sisters in the 1830s. These are examples of the kinds of things we could start thinking about, of how to use uniquely Mormon vehicles for direct action strategies. We'll get to that later. So I'll pass to Ashley.
This is all to be prompting your good brains.
Right. So these are things to stir the pot, and then we'll come back to
late night imaginings. So I just want to talk for a minute about what I said earlier of this concept of faith without works being dead, and the idea of organizing to actually affect material change in the world. And to do that, I want to share a very short story, which is that when I was working for a collective in Northern California a couple of years ago, one of my friends who only knew about Mormonism from South Park and Proposition 8 came up to me and said, just like cornered me basically in the hall, and he was like, so Ashley, how did they do it? I was like, I need some context. I have no idea what you're asking me. And he's like, they, your people, the Mormons, how did they do it? And I was like, how did they do what? And he's like, how do they organize so brilliantly for the things that they want? And I was like, well, that's a really good question. And we should sit on a couch and so stand in a hallway and talk about that. So we talked about that pretty much the whole night. And what I thought about as I tried to answer his questions, in the end, he pressed me. He was like, will you please write a manual on how activists on the left can use the principles of Mormon organizing on the right to win our causes? And I said I would. And that is a third finished document in my computer somewhere, but maybe I'll be re-inspired to do this. But as I talked to him that night, I realized that I set up a tension earlier between having an intellectual or a kind of writerly response to destruction happening in the world, which is important. I'm a writer, so I'm not going to dog it. It's very important. But to do that alone, which is a lot of what the left in Mormonism does, or a lot of what the, you know, dissident culture, whatever you want to call yourselves, whatever, you replace it with your favorite name for yourself. That's a lot of what we do on the left. But on the right, and in our, and also not just on the right, but in our daily experience with Mormonism, we deal with one of the most organized and effective bodies and collections of people that I've ever encountered, right? We can get things done. Like, I remember a woman coming to my ward, my parents' ward, and talking to us about refugees that had just settled in Salt Lake from Burma, I believe. And she said, they need coats, they need a friend, they need someone to teach them the bus routes, they need blah, blah, blah. Within a week, Mormons had just championed the request, and they'd raised thousands of dollars for these refugee folks, and they had befriended them, and they had shown them the bus routes, and they were getting it done. And I asked, what if we had the same response to the reason that there were refugees? What if we had the same organized response to war in general, or to economic inequality in general, the things that create these symptoms? What would that look like? It would be pretty amazing. And so I want to talk about, or just throw out a few ideas for how we could harness the Mormon model of organizing for things that we on this panel believe in, and hopefully that you in the audience believe in. And so if I were to write, and when I talked to my friend David and told him about a manual that I could write, because he's basically making me write it extemporaneously by speaking it out loud, I said, well, I don't know. And I brought up the idea of visiting in-home teachers. So as Mormons, for example, we could decide that we were Mormons against MIT, or Mormons against the 1%, or Mormons for social equality, however you want to phrase it. And we could have a program similar to the visiting in-home teaching program, where we write up tracts about information and our positions on social inequality and on war and on capitalism and on things that harm our brothers and sisters around the world. And we could have assignments to go visit each other and share those articles and talk about our responses to it and educate and strengthen each other in the effort to actually oppose inequality on the planet. Or we could do something like whenever Mitt comes into town to do whatever he does when he's in town. I'm never invited, actually. But when he comes into town, we could have people who are, you know, missionaries against Mitt who could go from door to door and distribute tracts that we've written as missionaries and explain to people what Mitt Romney is doing to them in their daily material lives and why they should be in opposition to him and how they could join us. Is that a hand?
Yeah. It's a beautiful thoughts, except none of this works without devotion to a prophet. That's what gets people collecting coats for refugees. And that, if you don't have that as your motivator, getting a random group of people, or people even united around a particular political cause or something, to have that level of volunteerism and willingness to say, when they get a call from their local file leader, say, oh yeah, I'll jump up, I'll be there Saturday because, you know, because Ashley called me. I just don't see how you can write a book or how you can capture what works for Mormonism without having the devotion to the central figure. I mean, am I wrong about that?
Sure, we can have a couple responses and then let's save some of this because we're getting close to the section where we actually talk this out as a group. So yeah, a couple responses. Thelma,
I feel like a modern day problem is sometimes important because the doctrines are Christ's doctrine. And I feel like if you follow Christ's doctrines of more of those state of being comfort and like taking care of the poor and the importance of that, I think what propelled people to help the refugees wasn't a prophet, but because of their own Christian beliefs. I think the modern day prophets are as crucial as just like following Christian values of like taking care of the poor and what that means.
So we have JB and Kim.
Sure. I just think that rather than overstructure as a response to the prophet, historians to the kids, I would hope that prophets are more devout to their principles.
You probably have a different
So I wanted to say something somewhat slightly in between these two points of view. People could have read about the refugees in the newspaper and they would have done it. But I don't think it's just the idea of a prophet. I think that there's something about loyalty to the organization, there's something about believing it's Christ Church that's asking you to do this. Or, you know, it's not this one individual, and it's not even authority. It's something about the structure that you're... There's the charismatic structure, and you're being, as part of that, asked to... Because I really believe that, you know, people could have found out about that in the newspaper and they wouldn't have done one-tenth as much as they did because they were asked by the church. I mean, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I try to do a few things myself, but I think the rule is
different. I think the key point is that there was somebody organizing and somebody asked them. Yeah, so it's not just like they read the newspaper. Somebody came to them and said, okay, this is the plan, this is how we help, and then people filled up. So I think what kind of Ashley interested in explaining more is like if there was a plan and somebody came up to people and said like, okay, this is our plan, this is why we believe it, we get on board, that's easier than people just being like in the world not knowing what to do.
And so we should get into these targeted conversations more, and I promise the discussion is coming, and we're about to wrap up this talking at portion. But I would say a couple of things as I throw out one more example. Interestingly enough, in that conversation with my friend, he said, you know what we're missing, though? Hellfire. And he was like, we don't have hell. What's going to motivate people? And we were laughing about that. And I was like, well, how about catastrophic climate change? How about the destruction of war? And I think the difference is... For me, one of the big differences growing up Mormon is that Mormons were not afraid to expect a lot from me. They were not afraid to be like, hey, you should pay 10% of your tithing. Hey, you should come to church like 3 times a week, you know? Like, I tell people about my life as a Mormon, and they're like, wait a minute, rewind, what did you do with your time and money? And so I think it's just that culture of saying we ask a lot from people, or we expect a lot, or we actually expect to get what we want. So that's the attitude I'm talking about. Right now we're talking about examples in activism, we call it base building, right? Creating those kinds of communities so that they're not isolated individuals when a problem comes up. They're people who already talk to each other, who already have affinity with each other, who are asking a lot of each other for a cause and a goal that they've clearly defined. And I don't think that happens. So my challenge is, like, I don't think it's going to be millions of people. I think it's going to be an intense pocket of people, if it is anything at all. I mean, that's up to us, right? But I think it's the issue of asking for a lot from people and creating that culture where that is expected and where you actually expect to win. And I don't talk to a lot of Mormons when I talked about, like, getting the priesthood or whatever for women. I don't talk to a lot of them who are like, no, I'm gonna win. Like, I want the priesthood. My goal is, like, 2 years to have this many people, you know? We don't talk like that. So it's an issue of talking like that. And one other example I was going to use is just, like, these are all just riffs, right? These are just, like, what is Mormonism? We can talk about this, but we wanted to kind of get an example of more, like, direct action and an example of base building so we could connect it with our activism. And one more example of base building is if you said, hey, you know, instead of starting a chapter of this Mormons Against Mid or whatever we call it, you know, in your hometown, you can start, you know, whatever this group would be called. And as part of it, we have our own social justice tithe. And we give 10% of our tithing to groups that are fighting on the front lines of these issues. Or we identify groups and educate ourselves about groups that experience the realities of economic inequality and war, and we actually give our money to them. So just like modeling Mormon successes and in our own way, I think is very powerful, if only to help us to see that we can be organizers who stand in solidarity with people in a different way than we have. So that's just a short example of base building. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, just along this idea of the prophet and tying into your base building. You know, I think we have powerful tools within Mormonism. I understand your comment that, yes, people do things because of the prophet, even though the prophet, to be honest, is just a figurehead. I mean, Thomas S. Monson really isn't saying that many things, to be honest. But having said, I think we have some things in our faith. For example, the idea of by common consent, right? You know, in our history, we've moved from local, now our funds are in the general. We've moved from local manuals, now they're correlated general. We've moved everything out of the local, so there's this appearance that that's where everything has to come from. But the reality is we have the tools and ability to reclaim things locally. You know, when the house a few houses down from mine has a tragedy, we, in my ward, have a local fund where the money actually stayed locally and went to this family. So there's ways that can be done that can still take that community. You know, when someone has a newborn baby, people show up with food and everything. And I don't think that's because of the prophet. I think that's because those are people they live with and they go to church with and are part of their community. So if there's a way to reframe that and let the members know, look, you have consent. You have the ability to make these decisions independent of the general or this hierarchy. To do these things. That's part of our tradition. That's part of our doctrine. All things shall be done in the church by common consent. And so I think there's tools there that can be used locally to get people to be motivated outside of sort of this hierarchical, a prophet has to say it. Because the community, people, when they are part of a group and part of a community, will do things if they feel that's benefiting the community. It's a group effort.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit and go to some group work. We believe in group work. And we're going to start that off with 2 examples. Because related to this, of course, one of the lucky things about organizing is you don't necessarily have to rely entirely on people's highest idealistic principles in order for them to organize, right? People organize sometimes pretty quickly when their pensions are being taken away. They organize pretty quickly when their neighbors are being put in cages and sent to other countries. They organize pretty quickly when their children are being sent to die in bad wars. And that is possible, and it happens pretty frequently. So we're going to give a couple of examples of base-building organizations and how they organize quickly, and then we're going to move to examples of how, from the group here, of how we could do those sorts of things as Mormons.
Let's start with. So I'm just going to explain a little bit about the tactics of a group called IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. Has anybody heard about them in this group? Okay, so you might have seen them recently. They took part in the anti-NATO protests in Chicago. a few weeks back, and they returned their medals from wartime and threw them and gave really beautiful speeches about why they didn't believe in war. It was really moving, so you should watch that if you haven't. But they don't just give speeches in public. They also do a lot of really profound work on the ground that we could look to in terms of, like, immediate relief, something that helps people in the immediate term that also creates a culture that is against things like war and economic inequality. So they have a campaign called Operation Recovery, and they basically say almost every, I can't remember the statistics, but a third of people who come home from fighting wars have either post-traumatic stress, sexual trauma, or...
Traumatic brain injuries.
And so they said, if all we did was say, those people have the right to heal, and we are going to help them heal, and they cannot be re... Redeployed. They can't be redeployed without having the right to heal. That would take a third of the members that are currently eligible for military service away from the military, and the military would not be able to function in the same ways that it does now. And so they combine immediate material relief for people who have suffered a lot because of these wars with a campaign to actually decrease the people, the bodies that need to shoot the guns that actually let war happen. And so they do this by... in a lot of different ways, but they're fighting campaigns for a right to heal, you know, through a lot of direct action, through people actually, civilians can come and form civilian alliances with IVAW chapters and actually start the healing work in their communities. And they also do things like when they help people who want to go AWOL or who want to refuse military service in the future to do that, and they help to hide them, and then they help to defend them when they go back and turn themselves in so that they're not redeployed. And they want to step this up and continue to escalate this behavior on a massive level so that we actually have fewer people who are actually enlisting in the wars that need, that the 1% need to have fought. And so that's one example of people who are combining neighborhood healing and also a plan to actually reduce the number of people who would actually participate in these kinds of wars and this kind of economy.
Yeah, so we're going to give two examples. That was one from war, and then give the other from capitalism, which are, of course, inseparable. The example I'm going to give is a group that I've been working with for a number of years called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Anybody familiar with them, what they do? Cool. The worst working conditions in the United States of America are in the tomato fields of Southwest Florida. It's a lot fighting for that place, for that ranking, I'm sure. Wages and working conditions have consistently been what the Department of Justice refers to ground zero of modern-day slavery in the United States. Over the last 9 years, there have been over 1,000 workers freed from forced labor just east of Naples, Florida, in Collier County alone. So we're talking armed guards chained up at night, threats to family, documents confiscated, that sort of slavery. So they started organizing, and they were trying to figure out how to do what charity groups had done in the past, but through an organizing approach instead. So charity groups do a lot of organizing to try to end slavery, right? By doing advocacy, they write about it, they make films about it, they raise awareness about it. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers decided, we are the tomato pickers that are at greatest risk of this kind of thing. We're going to end slavery by empowering ourselves. And so now there's about 6,000 undocumented tomato pickers in South Florida out of an industry of about 10,000 workers that have been organizing for about 15 years to basically take over and create economic democracy within the tomato industry. So far, they're about two-thirds of the way there. They've gotten binding contracts from pretty much the entire fast food industry and food service industry through years and years of direct action campaigns. We got Taco Bell kicked off of 30 university campuses. We did Burger King and McDonald's and Subway and Whole Foods and Trader Joe's campaigns over the years, and succeeded in getting not only a wage increase, but 90% of the farms in South Florida, as a result of the pressure coming from those campaigns, have finally, for the first time in U.S. history, started paying minimum wage, have started actually having a grievance process that's administered by the workers, which is basically not the case anywhere else in the country, where if a worker is raped by a supervisor, then there's actually, and they and they denounce it, that if that person is fired for the denunciation, then the farmer no longer has a market. They can no longer sell to the buyers Taco Bell and Subway and McDonald's. And so they've managed to basically transform from the field to the end buyer the entire industry. But they've only done it through base building, right? And that's their approach to trying to end slavery rather than sort of the charity approach that's often used. So those are two examples of what we mean by base building, right? And also maybe speak a little bit to why we have some hope that people might in fact organize, not just out of the principle of anger or of righteousness, but also out of the principle of solidarity, that it affects them in some way. And of course, we here are arguing for solidarity with those most affected, which does in some cases require some imagination and goodwill. So we're going to go from there.
Okay, cool. So this is where you guys all come in. And we're just kind of going to break down some categories of ways to rise up against unjust systems and change them. And then what we're going to have you do is talk about some of your ideas and figure out where they fit in here. What am I missing? This is obviously not a complete list, and if you have something to add to the list as a category, feel free to do it. But we have direct action, which we gave you some examples of, material relief, which is like solving the immediate problem, often called mutual aid, funding, needs money, media, writing, stuff that we do really well right now, about what our principles are and what we are opposing, etc. So if we were to write, I guess we just have to do like a big organizing category, because that's its own thing, like how your method of organizing. So we have a bunch of different things. So for example, Tristan's Zion's Camp would probably go under direct action. And it might also go under material relief. And
the Hero Bank.
Science Bank. My hidden agenda is for you. You guys really should join Science Bank.
We're all going to go open accounts.
Science Bank goes under funding. They've offered generous amounts. So Science Camp might go under there. And then organizing, so like the Mormon model I was describing might go under there, and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers might go under, and a lot of these things overlap, right? They're just Venn diagrams of awesomeness. But so we want to just kind of do, it's like a go round, but we're not in a circle, so it's like a go trapezoid or whatever it is we're doing here. We have a lot of people in this room, and we could do one of two things. We could just kind of have you raise your hand and popcorn out ideas, and it would just be an idea kind of like gathering session. And the idea and the question we want to hear your answer to is we noted it. Oh yeah. So for you to talk about, to describe or give an example of a kind of action or a category of action, or maybe even a specific action if your brain's been working real well this afternoon, that we could potentially engage in to actually try to defy the things that Romney stands for. And so it can be like, oh, I heard that in this group they did this really cool thing. It could be something like that, or it can be a category of action, like you're missing something in these underlying categories on the board. We could also do something in this category, or it could be specific. Like, I want to throw a giant pageant with sequined leotards about Mitt Romney and his history. Whatever it is, you know? So you can talk. So we can go, each person, you can pass if you want, so everybody has a chance, or we can just raise our hands and popcorn out ideas. What do you all feel like doing?
Raise your hands.
Raise your hands? Okay, is that cool with everybody?
Can I start?
Yes, you can.
Let me do this real quick. I think one thing we need to do is clean our own house. Because we are Mormons. This is our faith community. And the power rests with us in the Doctrine and Covenants. It says that all things shall be governed by common consent. What we've allowed to happen is we've allowed all the money. When I was a bishop in 1990, they transitioned and said, look, all the money has to be sent centralized instead of keeping money locally with the fast offerings. And it used to be that if I contributed eggs or milk or whatever, it had to be distributed locally. The law of tithing says that the money's supposed to be remain locally, and it's supposed to be for feasting, rejoicing, and for the widow. Not 0.7% to go to humanitarian relief, while the rest goes to developing a corporate model or building this empire, so to speak. So what we've done, or people have done, not me, we've created a petition called By Common Consent, and it has a doctrinal that's very positive and says, look, sign this petition. It went out last week, and it's growing fast, and it's going to other nations, Sweden, Brazil, people in other countries. I just want to pass this out, and I'm done.
And it says what?
It says that we simply want to return to what we did for 130 years, that whenever we, all money that goes into the church treasury can only be taken or used only by voice and common consent of those members of the church. That was taken away in 1959, 1960. We quit doing that. And I think we could demonstrate in our own faith community that this isn't something that's negotiable that the church can take away. This is something, power we had, that was just taken away, and we just want to return. We're talking about the voice of the prophet and so forth. This is just simply something I'll pass out.
I would just say, though, that it seems to me that the voice of the prophet says, I think we should stay with the current system. Now,
I understand.
Let's all raise our hand and say,
let's just start the dialogue.
So we'll keep going around.
Yeah, so we're gonna popcorn, and then for a couple, like, popcorn. Sorry, I'm using the worst jargon from doing this too often. Okay, popcorn over there, but just for this, for about 10 more minutes, we're going to just harvest ideas from people, and you can add on to another person's idea, but after we're done, then we'll have a discussion about the ones that seem most interesting to us, or the one that seems like we maybe would want to get involved in, or whatever it is, and bring up issues or bring up additions. Right now, we're just harvesting ideas. So, yes, let's hear you.
I'm from California, and when we had our governor election, and Meg Whitman, who is actually Romney's bud, was running, the California nurses, Kate, we decided to come up with a meme, and we dubbed her Queen Meg, because, you know, she was like royalty 1%, whatever. And then we made fun of her, and wherever she went, we would have our little protests and things like that. So I was just thinking, we wanted to come up with something about Mitt Romney that is something that embodies, you know, if there's something that we could, you know, in one characterization, embody all of these things that are the Nephites that are rich and vain and about to be destroyed kind of thing. And then that would be then something that we could have, you know, a targeted and what we found is the very best kind of things that you can do is if it's something that is funny. If it's something that people can, you know, realize, you know, there is humor to that, there is truth in comedy. So anyway, that's just kind of a tactic. Mm-hmm. And if we can fill in what that blob is that we want to define it as, that we want to go after.
I'm going to call that messaging, in terms of like trying to create a frame out there that people can actually take on in an informed way, in like the meaning.
And people, we were talking, we were kind of moving in that direction too, and we were talking about billionaires for Bush, if anybody remembers that, who dress up as billionaires, etc. Funny things like, you know, people with like golden trumpets that blow out the 1%, like a flag that says the 1% or something to like follow him around and interfere with his, with his, you know,
right,
public, whatever, persona. So we've got here, and then in the back.
We need to keep the leaders of the church, we need to keep them in line in a way. About 2 or 3 weeks ago in the paper, there was a story about how the church came out with its usual standard statement about the church is neutral in political dealings, and leaders of the church should not be personally involved. And that very same week, the general authority, Craig Swick, used his church email to fundraise for Wellmeet. And the newspaper, local newspaper, covered that. There were, and a lot of us, I and several of my friends, called Slater's office to complain about that. It was a small thing. I don't know the library difference, but it got bad newspaper press around here, and so the media keeping people and phone calls do make a difference to them. They need to be watched and called.
Okay.
Part of that is that we've got no. Yes, we've got to, you know, versus again media.
A mechanism. Yeah.
I'm going to write up here challenging official discourse.
And Thelma said a watchdog kind of for LDS political action. Okay, so back in the back.
I'm confused, and I loved your presentation, but I have to say, I'm confused as to whether you don't want Romney to win the nomination, or you don't want him to win the presidency. I'd rather he win the nomination than the rest of the towns in the Republican Party are worse than yours because they're stupid. So, what do we do? You already said, Tristan, that he hasn't actually gotten the nomination.
No, but that's
but it's a shooting thing. But are we saying that you would rather have Obama? You said there's really no difference in foreign policy and domestic economic policy. Almost no difference. I think Obama needs to be elected for the sole reason that I don't want any more Republicans on the Supreme Court. But other than that,
I cannot see that.
What are we doing? I just want to know what the goal is, so it helps me to focus on what kind of action.
I'm going to say everybody in here probably has a different goal, and one of the purposes of organizing is that people can work together, even who have different goals. So I'm going to guess that each person here could give a different answer, probably, for whether they'd like to see Romney or Obama or no one or somebody else elected.
And I think that's why, in the beginning, the way Tristan and I framed it is, this is less about partisan politics and more about these issues, right? It's not about, you know, making sure Romney doesn't get elected or Obama gets elected, but what they represent, right? The structural things that they represent, either one of them. And so challenging Mitt is just a unique opportunity we have coming from where we are to sort of pick what are these structural things that Mitt represents.
Exactly.
There's a stage here where Mormons can do things through direct action otherwise, well, to get an audience that they might not ever have because Mitt is in that position.
Divorce ourselves from.
Obviously.
But it's also, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's also practice. So this is, there are things that people could do from today on, whether or not he, you know, like, if he gets the nomination, and then if he gets elected president, or if he doesn't, the whole time, as Mormons responding to a Mormon candidate. But then there's also the issue of, this can just be an exercise, because what Mitt is a person who represents the 1%. So this is also an exercise of what kinds of actions do we want to take in general against that kind of economic concentration and political concentration of power. So there are unique aspects to it if it were Mitt, but there are also things that we can do if it weren't.
And along those same lines, when you're talking about, you know, Mitt getting elected or not, and we were talking about this before, you know, on some hands, some of us were thinking maybe Mitt getting elected would be the best thing for the left. Because when Obama got elected, the war movement died. All these other social justice movements died.
Yes, that's true. It's because he didn't make changes that he said.
I agree.
And Mitt Romney was like an I Claudius by Robert Graves, where
the
Emperor Claudius says, I was too good a monarch.
Yeah.
And therefore, I have continued the monarch.
I agree.
It would be better if I had stuck with the Republic and wanted to be killed. And so sometimes maybe we have the goal is subversive support. You support the opposition. So you let them destroy the country. Because the country is going to be easier to put back together again than it is to get rid of the Republican Party.
And I don't disagree with that. And
I'm actually going to hold people. See, this is what I'm talking about. Right. We want to have a conversation about this. I think we should. But I really want to actually, like, keep getting people's specific ideas, because then we can have conversations about whether they're effective or not.
Websites that show all of the positions that Mitt Romney has taken on any specific subject, so that you can see how he's gone back and forth and back and forth and all these, and the only consistent position he's taken is that he won't talk about his religion. I mean, if we had some kind of a way of exposing that he has something to hide on this religious aspect, maybe that would wake people up to the fact that there's something to dig into.
So specifically, would we do that through one of these methods or a different method, like writing or media work?
Website.
I don't know. I don't have the experience of organizing. I don't have the experience of some organizations. So it may be that you guys can. I don't know how to do that.
What religious aspect are you thinking of to expose?
Well, I think the revelation of the hypocrisy that you've been talking about Mitch being in the 1%, when his ancestors were living in Mexico under the law of consecration and stewardship, and how they weren't interested in other people, and he's only interested in the people that can serve him. That hypocrisy could be exposed, but I don't even know how to do it, or even if it would make a difference for people.
I'll stick it under here because this one needs to be written by somebody at some point.
And some of that actually, and some of that has been written, like Troy Williams' article exposes a little bit of that and a few others. But that's just an article that's out there in the webs, right?
Okay, so we have, and Tristan I think has an idea to elaborate on that too about Mitt Romney's history, right? So we have Natalie and you and Gary and then you. So Natalie first.
Okay.
Natalie, sorry. And so it's Natalie, as I don't know all your names, and then you, Gary, and then you in the back.
I liked what you were saying about sort of like bird dogging, wherever he shows up, have people show up with signs, even with scripture. I mean, I'm not Mormon, so I don't know what you would put on the signs. But, you know, something like the common consent, you know, put that on a sign and hold it up while he walks past.
Report it work.
Yeah,
or are you honest in your dealings with your fellow man?
Mormons for Corridor.
So
I'm going to call that follow him, hound him.
Okay, yeah.
But a positive sign that supports him by saying he's Corridor for a Mormon. He's a really bad guy.
Or a couple of cities for a Voldemort.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyways, I think that would be effective and just get a lot of his attention and attention of others.
So I think you have to be careful.
Oh, wait, so we have we have 1, 2, 3, and then you have 4.
Well, I don't mind talking about that. I think
we're going to talk about it, we just want
to talk about is that if we're talking about Mormons opposing the 1%, we need to get Mormons on board with that, first of all. And so an important thing, like, there's this talk about how you would mimic what the church organization does. You could just act like a parasite in there and take over that, right? We have these values about thinking of the collective, about even collective salvation, about being concerned for people. Zion is the ideal. It's always the ideal. But we don't talk about it. And so I think an important thing is how we sort of retake that history, that tradition, and reestablish it. How do we get people in our wards and stakes interested in these values and speaking out, having more of a voice? Like, these values are there.
So we want to go to specifics. How would you do that in your ward? How would you do that with your neighbors?
Even just one thing.
You can even be a little hypothetical, but
well, I think an easy thing is speaking up. Like, when I go to church,
I listen to
these lessons, and I don't like to make comments because I know people are going to jump on me. But even just having a goal that every class I sit in, I'm going to make a comment about these, that quote these scriptures. Quote about how Zion is always described as having no poor among the poor, and use the history that we have and make sure that people know that that's an important thing that fits in with any discussion that we're having. Or talks in sacrament. Even something more radical, like getting the people who are refusing to pay tithing now to start donating to a common fund in the community, someone who can act like the bishop, that maybe at some point people who have been turned away by the bishop will go to that person, knowing that some people in the community are funneling the funds there for that community.
That's great.
And I was going to say along his lines. Uh-huh. I mean, that's already happening. A lot of people are stopping to pay their tithing to the church. They're still paying tithing. It's just going to whatever individually they decide.
But they're going directly to Oxfam America or something.
Yeah, or wherever, but they're individually deciding. So, that, I mean, that's something that could certainly...
We're giving to Jesus the least.
So we have Gary, and then you in the striped shirt, I don't know your name, in the back, and then Tim, right? Okay, so Gary.
I was to say, I think you're kind of working in this room, you're working a very tiny sliver of fairly marginalized Mormons to begin with, if you're talking about working within Mormonism. And I'm kind of like Paul. My history has been one of watching protest movements try and fail and fall by the wayside. You mentioned two very successful ones, and it seems to me like what they both had in common is that they were organized and run by the victims. It seems to me like if I was trying to organize against the 1%, I would be focusing on trying to organize the bottom 50%. I mean, if you could get the poorer half of this country to work their own economic interests, you could probably solve the problem. I mean, the problem we have right now is the poor, especially the religious poor, tend to go with what their particular religious leaders tell them to be rather than pursuing their own self-interest. But I don't know if it's possible. Maybe it's not possible to organize the bottom 50% economic. But, I mean, this is a room of middle-class white folk here, and you can get all these rally a few of them to get in any protest movement. But you're not going to get any kind of... You're not going to get any momentum, any kind of critical mass from within at least the Utah Mormon community, which is against the middle-class and white. And I guess that would be my argument. If you are going to ultimately be successful, it seems to me like it has to start. You know, I mean, part of Mormonism is since 1920, the Mormon Church has never seen a bar that didn't buy. I mean, I tend to be on that level. I've never heard a general authority condemn a bar. I mean, they're just delighted. I mean, I have to assume that God approves of the war.
George Romney said he was brainwashed.
Gary, I'm going to give two examples of what you're saying. So one would be with Iraq Veterans Against the War. So what I wrote up for you, sort of riffing off of what you're saying, is to join an alliance with those who are most affected, right? So Iraq Veterans Against the War does this by joining alliances with the Iraqi trade unions in Iraq that are the most targeted by the current government for assassination. It does work with those trade unions who are trying to stop their oil from being stolen by Western companies. Perfect example of an affected community and people that are trying to join solidarity with them in an unusual alliance. Right? A second example would be that in my parents' ward in northern Alabama, after the Alabama immigration law passed, it took 1 month and half of the Spanish-speaking ward had left the state. I spent about 2 months after the Alabama law passed going down and spending time with the Spanish-speaking ward, talking about where people were going, about how they wanted to organize to challenge the Alabama law. These were Mormons. They're conservative in many ways, but Mormonism does not simply consist of privileged people.
Okay, so we have... what's your name in the striped shirt?
Al,
and then Kim, and then Renee.
I guess what angers me about this whole election is that whether it's Romney or whether it's Obama, it's still going to be Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
It's still going to be the banks. And it really frosted me that we see a quote-unquote progressive politician raising money with the capitalist line. I mean, it was a joke. I was held up at the Baltimore airport for an hour and a half while the president had to get on Air Force One to fly from Baltimore to Philadelphia to raise $10 million. I don't think any of us could have gotten into that room to raise money. So I'm wondering if we start tracking what they're actually doing, and with whom they are meeting. And showing with whom they are meeting, you know, by their fruits you should know them. And, you know, I think a pox on both of their houses, you really won't, sorry, I don't think it will make any difference. Because it's the same, Goldman Sachs people. I mean, Hank Paulson was Goldman Sachs. Timothy Geithner is Goldman Sachs.
Right, so you're talking
same seat, same chair.
So this is really key, right? Sometimes we have access to information if we actually do track people, especially Romney, as Mormons that other people either wouldn't know what to do with or wouldn't have access to. So that's a kind of research in terms of tracking them, figure out things about them that can be shared with some of those other affected communities.
If someone's going to spend $35,000 to have a tape,
you
probably figure out who they
are.
Yeah.
And there's websites that track that.
And he paired.
Just Park City, but never know who was there.
But networking of information, like the Pentagon Papers, our generation, when that came out, that brought down the Vietnam War, in my opinion. And so the tracking and information, the collective intelligence and the age of information makes a difference. It can make a difference because we can have those revelations, and then the 99% or 50% can say enough is enough.
Ron, on that, I'm going to write infiltration because this is something that Mormons have access to.
And also, there is he paired it with a scripture. This work is being done, but part of like these ideas that are being generated is how we can put a uniquely Mormon spin on them and see ourselves as a body of people who are resisting these things as Mormons or bringing a Mormon spin to it. So this gentleman said, by your fruits you shall know them. You know, you could have it paired with something that speaks Mormon's language and that they understand. So that's one example. So we have Kim and Renee and what's your name in the back? Andrew, and what's your name? Rick? Okay. So Kim, Nate, Andrew, Rick.
So, first I want to say, I think you have to be incredibly careful about calling people names like Coral, unless you know exactly how you're defending that point of view by it. And I can make the case, but I'm not sure you can. good. Okay. I want to know it.
No one would know what a name like Coral is.
Right. No, outside the group. But,
yeah,
but
it's an inside joke.
Wait,
right?
Let me talk about what I wanted to say. I think it's important to change the conversation within the church. It's important to do the speaking up that you were talking about in Sunday school. And I'm in a very liberal ward, and so it's easy for me, and I deal with this all the time. And the last time we went through the four more things, somebody says, so who is this guy? And he says, oh, he's a liberal. And I went, what? He's talking about survival of the fittest. He's talking about, you know, being strong or being smart, and that's how you get ahead, and that's all that matters in the world. And what I want, what I think would make sense, is if every week we had on a website, this is what the gospel doctrine class is this week, this is the topic we're going to be discussing, here's a way to talk about the real issues in terms of the scriptures that we're reading today. And, you know, we could have used that a couple weeks ago, but we went through Korahar again. And, you know, if I had written down something on a website with how to talk about Korahar and the 1%, it actually 100 people in different wards could have read it and said something useful in Sunday school class. My concern is that it's very hard within the ward family context to step outside the expected behaviors for most people in those wards, because you don't want to alienate. These are your brothers and sisters that you count on for 100 other things, and you don't want to alienate them. You don't want to get too far outside the group.
Great, that's great. That's a great contribution. We'll look for web creators.
Okay, Renee?
Yeah, I have three things, but some of them you sort of touched on, but I would say three things. One is that you just mentioned, in all of the media that we're trying to do about this, if they're trying to target a specific context, always pair it with the scripture, always pair it with the doctrinal principle, because that's more of the context. The second thing is people creating actually more meaning. So, I mean, actually, I'm sure people who teach gospel doctrine classes, at those gospel doctrine class lessons, tweak a little bit. I know there's a manual, but tweak it, like just do it. Speak a different language, have a slightly different lesson. And if there were teachers around the country who were doing this, we'd actually infiltrate the church meeting itself. And the other thing is outside of the church meetings, because that can be dangerous, I'm sure, have a board barbecue, or you invite a local organization that's doing work on this stuff to do a presentation, or as a local club through the local group called Local Men. They would be happy to come do a presentation on capitalism, on corporate rule, and on the violence of corporate oppression to
go through the Mormons. Maybe it's because of the European or whatever. You know, but just that's one of the great things about the Mormon Church, is that there are these Mormon families that have gatherings. So have a gathering, invite those people, and then you're not even responsible for the message. But it starts the conversation.
Okay, so what did you write for that?
I'm going to call it Popular Education Gatherings.
Popular Education Gatherings. You've got a word. PEG, for short. Yeah, Andrew, was it? And then Rick?
Three things that didn't kind of address a little bit in some of the previous ones. First of all, having a sort of repository so that people can know how to react to some of the things that I said. I was thinking about a session I had before about how some of the apologetics groups started. It was kind of, they kept on getting barraged, and it was, they could answer one at a time, but by making, you know, the wiki where all the issues and all the answers are, like the repository, that helped. Well, we kind of need something like that where we know what is generally going to happen in Sunday school class. So it needs to be a repository where you know this is how you respond. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, so in the board context, you know, there may be a certain character reward, maybe more little boards than others, but that's only a sliver of people who are members of the church. Because there are people who are less active or inactive and things like that. And so the church is trying to say, hey, let's kind of reactivate these people, but it might be that the reason that these people are not active is because they think that their political opinion or whatever cannot be expressed. Kind of going with, you know, speaking up in class, there has to be a way where, you know, in reaching out to these people to kind of convince them that it's possible, one, and it is, you know, Christ-like, it is, you know, really part of religion to kind of stay in there, even though, you know, the environment may be a certain level that in the industry. So that's the second one. Third one is, so there's a lot of problems with kind of doing some of these things if the regular membership or the regular board isn't on board. One thing that really helps is if they can get an effort like, you know, very innocuous or innocent things, so, you know, kind of have some kind of drive or, you know, something that anyone would want to do because you've told them before, something like that. Then once you are known as someone who will volunteer in the board to start these programs, then you are more able to say stuff without having, you know, the backlash. Because they know that you're someone that helps out. So in any time that you're trying to have, you know, some kind of event that, you know, an event that does do direct relief or direct action, just try to figure out if it's something that doesn't have the overt political message, or something that could be done at the board level. So then they go, this person volunteers to help in board activities, and then they'll give you the chance.
Building trust.
Cool, thanks. And Rick, right?
Yes.
And then we're going to close the thing and just kind of recap, because we only have a few minutes left, so go ahead.
This is my own personal experience, but, you know, I grew up, born in 51, grew up in the Vietnam era. My parents were moderately conservative Republicans. Actually, my father performed at Romney's marriage. Anyway, so I saw thousands of protests on television. It was like every night in the 60s. And I really didn't understand what Vietnam was about until about 1980. And in fact, I voted Republican until, I didn't vote for Reagan, but I did vote for the first Bush in the Republican primary. My own experience is, you know, my parents and others and kind of the whole environment said, well, those anti-war protesters, they're just kind of cowardly and they're not patriotic and stuff. Oh, okay. Yeah, I just sort of bought into that kind of analysis. And and to this very day, I still have never been in a protest, but in the Ogden Standard Examiner, I've probably written 500 pieces, you know, attacking free market ideas and so forth like that. I don't know. But
I'll bet
that's what's
one good.
Yeah. I'd love to see some op-eds in the Trib and the Examiner and on these lines, right?
Can I just throw one last quick thing?
Mm-hmm.
I got lined up. I was just inspired by something I heard back here. And I'm not convinced Mormonism can be reformed from the ground up. It seems to me like it's a kind of top-down religion. But if it can, and if it could be, I was just saying, wouldn't it be great if there were a website and somebody who actually reviewed each of the correlated lessons a week or two in advance and put up a couple of references to specific scriptures and specific truly Christian concepts that could be thrown in that would not be threatening, you know, that wouldn't be bringing the spirit of contention into the lesson, but could still get the point across that these notions, these Christian ideas that we all see as liberal ideas, could be introduced in a conservative ward in a non-threatening way. I'm one of these guys, I have a hard time raising my hand. You're just crunching your teeth. But if somebody actually put someone to it, like I said, oh, this would be a good time for you.
Wait, hold on, we got a hand up
here. Just a second, I know you want to control it.
We have a hand, though, that was before yours.
Because I have to leave. In 1992, we did the Mormon Alliance. We did case reports. We exposed large numbers of child molestations in the church. Very little good came from it, even though we did all this organizing, because you're up against, in the Mormon church, a very powerful reactionary force, which is that the church is always right. And you can go back and read the 4 or 5 volumes of this, you can go back and read the many, many volumes of dialogue in Sunstones, where many of these things were dealt with. And the thing I'm negative about is, I think it's great to organize the tomato farmers, but it's the Mormons, kind of their loyalty is to some other place, and I don't hear anything that you're saying to get them to detach from that. And I'm sorry I interrupted somebody else.
Say one comment on that, and let's see.
Okay, we actually are really running out of time, and I also would encourage people to respect the stack, especially when there's a woman. There's been a lot of men talking and talking over women. So, yes, go ahead.
Oh, so I just wanted to say quickly that organizers know, but when you go out to organize, there are people from kind of 1 to 5. And 1 are like totally with you and they'll do everything, whatever, and come on. And the 5s are like they're going to fight against you. And the 4s are like they just don't agree with you, whatever. And you have like 2s and 3s. And so that's kind of where you focus is, you know, you're not going to have all Mormons or you're not going to have the conservative ones, perhaps. But there are 1s and 2s among us that, 3s. All of these things
and that's
can educate. And it's enough.
So we want to make sure, so our session ends officially in 15 seconds. We want to make sure that this, if people are interested in it going beyond the walls of this room, that is something that's available. So we want conversation to continue. I'll be around for at least another 20 minutes if people want to talk among themselves. But we'd really encourage anybody that feels like there's a piece of this that interests you, please meet right here in 30 seconds, and we're going to make a quick list, yeah? And that list is going, you can indicate what kind of commitment you're making, right? You can indicate whether that's maybe, you can indicate whether I'm going to start this website people are talking tomorrow and I'll let you all know so people can start posting, depending on what it is you're thinking about. We want to make sure that this is something, because we may very well have this opportunity in this vehicle for 8.5 years, right? Hopefully. Well, depending on how you look at it, we might or might not, right? But there's not a short window of time for this kind of thing. So if it is a slow build, that's totally fine. So people that are interested in maybe pieces of this, come on up and feel free to talk among yourselves as well.
And 2 things really quickly on that. I would also, just as an observation of the conversation, we had a lot of great ideas come out of here. But one thing that I think is interesting to note is that most of us focused on how to change Mormonism from within, and that's one tactic, but there's also the tactic of a group, and it can be small, but I mean, I'm an activist. This is actually a big meeting if this were an activist meeting, right?
Yeah.
So there can also be a committed group of people who do their own thing outside Mormonism and who identify as Mormons. Like, they're going out to where Romney is. They're doing things out in the public, and they don't need to deal with the politics of the ward or whatever. They can actually go out and do other kinds of things. So there are other options, too, in different and diverging directions that can be undertaken. And one thing is that I'll just plug really quickly as a way of starting to have this conversation. The group that I'm working with, Move to Amend, is trying to address issues of corporate rule of our politics and our economy. And we are actually having a People's Movement Assembly on Wednesday, August 1st, from 5:30 to 9:30. And we want people all over the community to come in and start talking about specific solutions that we can create in our community to start doing for ourselves what we normally rely on this inequitable corporate and economic structure and political structure to do for us. And we would love to have people there who identify as Mormons. There aren't enough people who identify as Mormons who are involved in these kinds of communities in Salt Lake. And if you have ideas that we've talked about today or other kinds of ideas, then please come and we can. These are flyers for where it is. And that's a plug because I want this conversation to continue. Oh, do you want to announce that?
Also, anyone has heard of the small publication in one worker, which is now mostly an online presence? So we have a informal get together tonight after 7, but we'll be here at 7:30. A call up tonight, 7:30, to talk about the future of tomorrow, and which time we were to these folks. If you're interested in something, please see me, also in the address.
Mom's passing me around, your phone number. But thank you for coming, and thank you for all your ideas. And if you want to continue and figure out how to get involved, come on up.
Please stop by, even if you're just interested in getting information.